This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
This is iFanboy Pick of the Week 860, brought to you by iFanboy listeners just like you. I was born without a name, a soldier born. The streets they see these kids on a bench, running high of fame for the guillotine. No roots to fall in, no one to fix. My head's like a hey, this is Josh Flanagan. I'm here with my co-host, Connor Kilpatrick.
Hello.
We have returned at the turn of the tide, like Gandalf the White. This is iFanboy Pick of the Week, episode 860. Here in the Ron Richards Memorial Third Chair is Dr. Ryan Haupt.
Hello, everyone. Ready for another journey around this little star of ours.
Kicking it science style, doing the podcast. We're happy to be here. It is the 18th. Year of the show. Oh, that was like chewing. Have you ever had an MRI? Where they make drink like that chalky stuff?
No, saying 18th. MRIs.
Whatever it was I had, they made me drink some stuff.
Where was this clip,
no,
Josh?
Not MRI, the other one, CAT scan.
Josh, were you across the border? Were you?
Yeah.
Where were you? Listen, they said that the shark fluid would help me. Anyway. I got a CAT scan and you had to drink like this gross banana flavored stuff. And
I hope telling people about the spoiler warning doesn't mess up your humors.
Well, the point being, yes. Well, I have some leeches on my legs just for the show. The point is that saying 18th year of the show was like swallowing that horrible mixture. Thank you to everyone for listening. We got to get to it. Pick of the week is what this is. We each of us read a stack of comics. One of us gets the job of picking what they call the pick of the week. Just because it's the year, I'm going to tell you, it doesn't mean it's the book they liked best. Yep. Is it the best book from an objective standpoint? No. It might be a terrible comic book, but it touched you. It moved you. It made you think of something. It gave you something to say again after 18 goddamn years. We are Orion, which is less years, but it's still probably more than I want to think about. We are going to talk about that book, other books from the week. There will be a patron pick in which the patrons of iFanboy vote. They pick the one they like the best. We will answer listener mail if we have time. There is a spoiler warning in effect. We're going to talk about what happens in the books. You haven't read them. That's not our problem. Ryan, first pick of 2023.
Yep, I ran the numbers, and I can tell you objectively what the best pick... No, I'm kidding. The pick of the week was Fantastic Four Legacy Numbering 696. The new numbering, number 3, which I actually think is relevant because of what Ryan North with his team of Ivan Coelho and colors by Jesus Arbatov and letters by Joey C. is doing with the series, where the first four issues, they've kind of broken the team up into their components, and in doing so, they are kind of demonstrating what makes this family of adventurers such a powerful force when they are together. And I just think it's a really clever way to start a new Fantastic Four series. And this issue in particular is Johnny's issue. And Johnny is on his own away from the rest of the family and is trying to have a secret identity for the first time, which is a new thing for him. And he's working a workaday job at a big box store. And he's kind of just taking everything in stride. He's like, okay, the Baxter building's gone. Reed lost all our money, but like, he'll figure it out. We'll get it back. I just got to lay low for a little bit. I just got to figure this out. And he ends up essentially getting into like a unionization fight with this corrupt boss who realizes that the Human Torch doesn't actually hurt people. Like, the Human Torch does not go around burning people alive or even letting folks punch him. Like, when normal people throw a punch at the Human Torch, he's able to control his flame so that even if they hit him, they are not burnt. And so this jerk of a man realizes he can beat the crap out of the Human Torch in front of everybody, and the Human Torch can't do anything about it. And so Johnny has to like use his wits and use his charisma to find other ways to solve this problem, because he knows he's not a genius scientist. He knows he's not a pile of rocks. So it was really cool to see Johnny in a situation where he thought he had the upper hand. He realized he doesn't, and he has to kind of come up with the alternative solution to the problem presented before him.
From a science standpoint, I mean, you really have to, for the Human Torch, you really have to let that go. Like,
yeah,
there's so many things about that don't make sense. Like this guy who's on fire standing next to people and not cooking them inside is something you just have to overlook. But I had a really hard time with the idea that he could punch the Human Torch in the face, make his face, you know, pancake, and it wasn't burning himself. I was like, well, I mean, just I let it go, and I really enjoyed the issue. But at first, I was like, I mean, he's punching the flame with his hand. Like, it's okay.
I mean, you can punch a flame if you ever go camping. Like, you can do a little jab.
He's not punching through the flame. He's punching into the flame face. It was just.
Is Johnny's skin hot? Probably. I would assume so.
Well, even if his skin isn't hot, like, it gives you a question about like what it is he's controlling, because there's heat that comes off those flames, even if he turns off that spot. If there's a stove and there is a hand-shaped part of it that's not turned on that I can touch without burning myself, the heat around it is still going to affect me. Like, it's going to make you uncomfortable at the least.
I think the thing about this that rang true to me is the idea that Johnny would go out of his way, put himself in harm's way to prevent burning normal people with incidental use of his power. So even if the way that manifests and like, how do you consciously control that when a fist is flying at your face? Like, that, I agree, warrants further explanation. It doesn't warrant it for explanation, but it could be further explained. But I just, the fundamental premise of like, yeah, Johnny would avoid burning people alive.
And the funny thing is, I mean, we'll get off of this in a second, because the way they draw him now versus the way they used to draw him. And there's a page in here. It's page 10 of the Digital Reader.
Old school, yeah, with the lines.
Where he's like, you know, old Johnny had some flames coming off him. New Johnny has a fucking inferno around him at all times.
Practically the Phoenix.
And so it's like, guys, tone the fire down if you want me to believe he doesn't actually burn anything.
Did they resolve the superheated? I'm trying to remember how that.
Yeah, they ended. Did. The Nova Johnny got resolved in the last issue of.
Okay,
Death
so so this way that he is, because I was thinking like they're drawing him awfully super flamey. I mean, like everything around. Like, here's the thing: like the conceit is that he really at all times is in ultimate control of, and I think he says the heat, not the flame, because you know, just in that room, you know, with the beef and everything, like. I thought, oh, that must smell great in there. I genuinely was like, because there's huge slabs of beef hanging. I was like, oh, delicious. But like, you know, I got to say, just like, I liked this issue.
Yeah.
I had intangible issues with it. Like, I felt like I loved the last two issues. And I
liked he says he controls his fire to within a hair's breadth, not the heat.
Right.
Which I guess is the same thing, but whatever.
Yeah, but I mean, he'd have to be talking about the heat. Otherwise, just, you know, like a fire. It also, it's
well, like, we see him, like, we've seen him catch people when they're falling, you know, and he'll have one hand that's not on fire, mm-hmm. and the rest of him is on fire,
right?
But
you always have to overlook that with Johnny. Yeah,
yes, totally.
It's just when you focus on it, it's like any comic book thing. You can overlook any silly thing, but when you focus on it and make it a plot point, then it becomes glaring. Then the reader starts to think about it, and you go, wait a minute. But
and then I kind of wonder. I wonder if that's a good or a bad thing. You know, like in a normal story, like if in a movie or whatever, if you have to stop and think about it, you're screwed up. But in comics, when you stop to think about it, that's almost like a feature, not a bug. When you're trying to work.
It's the Grant Morrison thing. You don't want to think about the things that don't make sense too much, otherwise it all falls apart.
Yes, but also like as a reader, especially as an old, like it's kind of fun. As long as you don't let it ruin the story that you're doing and you get to do what we're doing right now and like punch at it a little bit, like it's fun. Like Ryan, I know you've talked on your podcast and like about, you know, how does Superman's power really work? And it's not a trying to punch a hole in it thing. It's just, or like we talk about gravity in Star Wars or something like that. It's established that we enjoy the story. That's not ruining it, but it's just a little fun aspect. Again,
I mean, at the end of the day, we have to have something to discuss.
But also, sure. My final thing is, if he never wants the flame to hurt anybody, what good is he then?
Well, I think
when he shoots a bad guy with his flame powers, what is he doing then? If it doesn't hurt
I think that's the premise of the story here is that, which is funny because I kept thinking about it as a reading. I was like, so he's really completely ineffective because he's not that smart. And he's like, at the end of this, I was like, well, what good is he? He wants to do the right thing. And there's places that he can. And I think that might have something to do with the fact, like, I didn't love this. I liked it. I really appreciated what they were going for. And like I said, I loved the last two issues, but I don't know that they nailed it for me. Which is to say I didn't enjoy it.
In the books that I was considering this week, it was either like heavy, dark, like, oh God, everything's going wrong and war is terrible. Or this issue that was kind of fun.
You don't have to justify it. Never justify it.
No, I'm not justifying. I'm just saying when I came time to make the pick, I thought about like, this is the book that I, in terms of, but, you know, this is the book I had the most fun with. Like, when Johnny reveals himself to the staff, they're like, yeah, we all know you're Johnny Storm. You talk about why the Human Torch is awesome more than anyone we've ever met.
He's like he's a nitwit.
Yeah.
Like, he's a complete nitwit. I like he's a mimbo. I don't know if that's still a thing that we use.
He's a himbo.
And I don't know that I don't know if I like that, but I respect it. Does that make sense? It's not my favorite. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it was bad. I enjoyed reading it, but it didn't quite hit all those buttons for me. Like, what is it for you? You're saying it was fun, you liked the scenario, like that was why you picked it.
And it kind of showed that, like, of the four of them, Johnny's thing is like he has this immense power, but his, you know, his ace in the hole is sort of he's very charismatic, and even if he's a himbo that is too cocky, people still like him. Like, oh, it's Johnny, you know,
right? Like, he's
in real
life,
this person could be very annoying, but.
Right, I think they write him almost too annoying lately. I feel like when he was young, that makes sense. But he's been around a while at this point. You know, morons in their 20s, pretty, you know, can mature in their 30s or whatever. And I know we don't want that in comics. So again, this is sort of goes two ways. But I feel like he's a little too, like, he should know more by now. Like, his sister's super smart. He's not.
They're not drawing him super young. Like, he's drawn as an in-shape superhero, but he's drawn as, like, a fully adult person in probably their, you know, early to mid-30s.
And like, Peter Parker is written as a full-fledged adult now. Not an old, you know, but, like, an adult. A person in their 30s. You know, young 30s or something like that. Self-assured, still with doubts or whatever. You know, like, if this was, I feel like there's movies about this. Like, every buddy comedy has the one character who didn't grow up enough, you know, and that's what they're going for with Johnny now. I guess I don't know that I don't like it, but it feels like I want to respect him more, and I'm not sure I do.
Well, you have to be okay with him being he's a kid. He's the younger brother. Yeah. He's always going to be the. That's always his personality. That's his role in the group, is to be the young, impetuous kid.
I mean, I also feel like in the early days of FF, maybe even within our lifetimes, it was thought that, like, we talked about how, like, Johnny is the most powerful because he's got this incredible flame ability and he can fly and he can do the Nova Blast. But then there was this shift where everybody realized, like, oh, if you actually explore Sue Storm's power, she's easily the most powerful. And so they're the sort of, maybe this is just my own interpretation, but sort of the mantle of, like, who the powerhouse of the Fantastic Four was has shifted, and it is now Sue, and so Johnny does maybe feel a little ancillary.
Well, especially if Johnny's flame powers are purely for show, apparently.
Well, maybe let him fly.
Yeah, I like the issue, but there's too much unraveling of the character here for their own good. But next issue, we're going to find out finally what happened and why they're in trouble and why they're broke and why the backs are building blown up and all that jazz. But I think the first issue was pick of the week. I think Josh said on the discussion of the second issue would have been his pick of the week again. So this is, you know, it's been an interesting and different run from Ryan North than we had with Dan Slott.
Yeah, it's
still enjoyable.
It's a great diversion from what Dan Slott was doing to sort of look at it in a completely different way. And I appreciate the thought that's going into these. Like, how can we do it? I like this structure. Like, let's spend time with each of the characters. Some shit's gone down. We're going to bring them together. It's a great tone. It looks great. I'm not dissatisfied at all.
It occurred to me while reading Gotham City Year One, Number Four, that I don't know how long this is going.
I had the same thought. I think this was you know, in the running for pick of the week until I realized it wasn't the final issue. And I was like, I don't know if I can do this anymore.
Well, I don't think it's bleak at all, but I think this feels like the reveal at the end of Act Two. So is this a 6-issue miniseries? I don't know that they may have, maybe they've said, King. But I haven't seen it. But Tom King doesn't normally go that 12. Short, but well, he's got shorter.
I was behind on issues on this, Connor, so I had to catch up this week. And so the dead baby is fresher for me, so it feels a little
dead bigger. Baby's harder for parents.
Yeah.
This is 6-issue miniseries. So this is right. The end of Act Two.
That's good. You know what? I thought this might be the end too, and then I realized it wasn't, and I was like, oh, yeah, we need a little more. I'm good with that.
Well, we just had the reveal of who's behind everything, so we still have to. That's what usually happens at the end of Act Two. So now you've got the final act to resolve it. But I still think, I mean, we talk about this a lot with this book, is that Phil Hester's doing incredible work here, and I really find the interesting panel and page layouts to be the thing that I find most rewarding from him. It's, you know, these giant. There's a lot of black and white. That makes sense in a noir comic, but there's a page 10 is like a giant. You know, what's Mr. Wayne's name here?
Richard
Wayne in the background.
He's a dick.
He's doing these interesting things I've never seen him do before. And I don't know if that's in the script or what, but I find what the visual look of this book to be fascinating.
Yeah, that page 18 where Mrs. Wayne kisses Slam, and like in the background, there's a bunch of
the previous
panels.
Page.
Yeah. Oh, is it the previous page? Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
I got to it going backwards. That is weird, though, because that is the part where he says, I'm 94 years old now. I was like, wait a minute. When does this happen?
Well, I think right. The narration
in the first
is
issue,
him
we saw that
writing
narration.
A letter
yeah.
To
he's Bruce. Narrating as an old man to
okay.
Batman.
I forgot that. So,
yeah.
Does this mean that Slam Bradley is Bruce's grandfather?
Could be. Oh, shit.
That was what I took away from this.
Possibly. Yeah, I think, I mean, that the standout for me is, like, the story's good. I kind of always think, I'm like, I don't know if I'm excited, but then I read it, and it's great, about a third or halfway through each of these issues, I'm like, who is drawing this? I forgot. And I look, and it's Phil Hester, and I just think, man, I hope this guy gets some real recognition for this work, because it's a guy who had been more or less left behind by mainstream comics. They bring him in for stuff every once in a while, but this stuff, this is great. Mm-hmm. I mean, and he's really good at different genres too. I mean, he can do like straight up superhero action adventure. He doesn't do, you know, Jim Lee, you know, Alan Grant kind of stuff, but he does this, and he does this really well. You know, a lot of Darwin Cook here. If you told me this was Darwin Cook, you know, or an Acolyte, you know, I would believe it, but I think he's just taking some of the stuff that he does really well. And man, these pages are so good. The beating at the end.
Yeah, like with the bat, like, that was...
Every time the bat makes contact, the light takes over the figure of Slam Bradley.
This almost had, like, Frank Miller Sin City vibes.
Yeah, it's a lot of those
things. It's a heavy
things.
Noir thing, yeah. It's interesting. I mean, you know, it can be too cutesy in the hands of a less talented writer in that,
right.
You know, the place where Slam beats the commissioner half to death and changes the course of Gotham City to become more crime ridden is being Crime Alley. And, you know, you can wince at that but the problem is it's so well done that it's okay. And
it can be cutesy because it's a comic book.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, that's a thing to keep in mind, even for us as readers. Also, like the idea of him beating this guy half to death, who he says isn't really a bad guy. I mean, like there was that previous
issue about, like, you know, there was a murder and then the obvious person confessed immediately, and it went through that like six or so times and said, you know, the murder rate in Gotham is way lower than Metropolis. And I think what I realized in this issue is, like, oh, none of those people were guilty. The cops are just beating confessions out of everybody. Mm-hmm. So I think he is a bad guy.
Well, I mean, but they
he wasn't a corrupt guy is what you're saying.
Right.
He was,
yeah.
He wasn't,
what
he wasn't
getting.
Corrupt. He was actually trying to bring crime down. He wasn't taking money from anybody.
Wasn't corrupt from the mob, but was still not doing police.
No,
work.
He
that's,
wasn't.
That's my read.
Well, but he wasn't corrupt in that he was in the way that Gotham City police are usually portrayed as being corrupt. He was actually trying to stop crime as opposed to other commissioners like Loeb we see in the future who aren't actually trying to stop crime but profit off of it. So that's what he's saying. That's what Josh.
Yeah. It's just,
about.
It's more of that gray than the black and white. Like, yeah. I mean, he kind of was acting like all cops ever acted, you know, for, you know, 100 years. That's kind of the deal. But he wasn't a villain in that straight up sense. It's great.
Right. And as soon as he goes away, then he says crime becomes out of control in Gotham and has never been under control since. So
So it's less safe as a result of that. And then that's a gray thing to do to Slam Bradley. Like he, you know, it basically was vengeance. He was pissed off what he did to him, and he beat the shit out of him, and he's our hero, quote unquote. That's a great choice.
Yeah, I think this is still a terrific book, and it's interesting how tight it is. Six issues is very unusual for Tom, so it's fun.
Yep,
I'm always excited to see when I see it. Dark Knights of Steel number 9. We are also entering into Act 3 here with Tom King's fantasy, not Tom, Tom Taylor's. And that happens to them in real life too. Tom Taylor's fantasy book, and this was great. This was I thought the last issue was really, really good, and I thought this issue was really, really good as well. And it was the reveal I did not see coming, and throws the whole thing into chaos.
I did. There's it's the third to last page, or no? See, it's page 20, slightly longer than normal issue. Is you just see they will look like us.
And yep.
Like, Skrulls. Nope. Martians. And then, so I thought that was really interesting. And then that last page where we learn that Alfred is not who he seemed is the absolute best thing about these kinds of series is that, and I've been saying that about this series the entire time, is that he is using the expectations of all these other Elseworlds things that all the characters are going to get on those same rails and go there with slightly different clothes on.
Mm-hmm.
But here they're like, nope, Alfred has been Martian Manhunter the entire time. And you can't see that coming because you don't expect it, because normally Alfred is Alfred is Alfred is Alfred, you know, right. And Jor-El is Jor-El. They're always going to be those same characters at the heart of these kinds of stories. But here he throws so much of that out the window. I mean, in this, Batman is Batman. That you can count on. Or you know, Ollie and Dinah.
But he's half Kryptonian Batman.
True.
Yeah, but he's still Batman. Like, you're talking about the core of the character.
Issue, I don't know. I felt like I lost the plot a little bit between this issue and last issue. There's a lot going on at this particular moment in the story. And the reveal of Martian Manhunter, while cool, is actually, there was an Elseworld miniseries that happened back in the early aughts called JSA Liberty Files. Tony Harris drew it.
Yep.
And they did a very similar thing where they kept hinting that the Nazis had a Superman. It's a World War II era Elseworlds. And they kept hinting that the Nazis had this Übermensch, this, you know, and he was called like Yawn or something. And then it's revealed that it wasn't Clark, it was Martian Manhunter. So this isn't the first time in Elseworlds that I've seen the Martian Manhunter revealed as a thing, which didn't diminish it here, but I feel like I had seen that before. And then Ollie as an archer, just with one arm, you know, Dinah just being like, yeah, just use a crossbow. And he goes, okay, fine. Well, I don't, that...
What
nitpick, but come on, what self-respecting archer is just gonna be like, fine, I'm a crossbow.
Well, he's got one arm, what else is he gonna do?
This is only option.
Use his teeth like he did in Dark Knight Returns.
That's a good point. I did like that, but Thank then again you. You'd be like, I already saw that in Dark Knight Returns.
I know, yeah, but at least it's still above.
I think that you're
he
right,
like, just shoot the one arrow.
The first bit of this, by the way, any comic I read this week, I was like, I have no idea what happened before this. Yeah. Every single one of them, like when I read the Parker Girls, I was like, oh shit. Like, I had to go. I read the entire issue before that. Anyway, the first half of it, I was pretty lost because I like the character, but I think those are like the characters are like, what the fuck is going on here? And I thought that too. And then, you know, you see it on that page 20, you know, there's two Lara-Els.
Yeah, well, in the last issue, Lara killed Hippolyta, and they were trying not to go to war, and she landed in the middle of the confrontation, killed the queen, and started the war. So that was,
which was really disarming. Like, I remember that. Yeah. I was like, what the hell is going on here? And so this issue, as I started to get myself back on board, but I think it was done on purpose, and I think it paid off. Like, you're like, oh, okay, Skrulls. I mean, white Martians.
I mean, there was an issue of Secret Invasion that came out this week, Josh. I don't know if you're reading that.
It was great. I don't want to talk about it, but it was
also
great.
Ryan Northbrook. Well, it's all really hard to reload a crossbow one-handed, so I think Dinah's bought him one extra shot at most.
Hey, better than I did have that thought. I'm not going to lie to you. I had that thought. I was like, "How's he gonna?" Don't worry about it, Josh. It's cool. They'll make a device. They got really smart people.
There you go.
Figure something out.
Yeah, this has been really fun. I'll be happy if this kept going, which is, you know, well, over the break we had DC versus Vampires, and then I was like, "I'm good with that. That's fine. No more of that." But
yeah.
But this could keep going as far as I'm concerned. Batman 131, Chip Zdarsky, and new artist Mike Hawthorne, which I think was my biggest problem with the issue, which I don't think he fit the story. Hmm. He's a good artist. I think he was a bad choice.
You what talk this, about it.
This I'm issue was So the end of the last issue, which was pick of the week right before we took the break, was that Batman was fighting that robot, and it zapped him with a ray, and everyone thought he was dead, but really he was just zapped into the multiverse, because now that the Dark Crisis on Infinite Earths is over, the multiverse has returned to DC. So he got zapped to a different Earth. And this is two stories. Bruce on the new Earth, which is, you know, different than ours, and then Tim and Dick dealing with Bruce possibly being dead again, and Tim and Dick not believing it. And just that, and then when you go from Jorge Jimenez, this incredibly dynamic, fun, you know, classic but also modern superhero work, Mike Hawthorne's a bit more, it's a bit more staid in terms of the art. It's not as powerful superhero. It's a very big contrast between the two styles.
He's gone to a different universe, right? So at least there's sort of a.
Yeah, I mean, but it's not like he's only drawing that. It was fine. It was jarring to go from Jorge Jimenez, who's doing some of the best work in comics overall, to Mike Hawthorne's doing. It's just going to pale in comparison.
Mike Hawthorne's a yeoman,
yeah,
of sorts,
yeah.
An incredible storyteller, I think. So, like, when I'm looking at it without the context of that, I'm like, "This is pretty good." But I understand what you're saying. Like,
I actually enjoyed the backup more, which Chip Zdarsky wrote. Also, in Miguel Mendoza drew, and it was basically about, you know, the fallout of Gotham City saying, "Well, Batman's gone. We're gonna, you know, the criminals gonna go crazy," and it was Dick and Tim trying to deal with that. So that was the second part of the story. I enjoyed that more than I did the main story, which was, you know, Bruce is waking up in this weird place and he doesn't know what's going on. He's got to figure it out. And
does Tim Drake feel like a more familiar Tim Drake in this backup
story? This has been a great Tim Drake through the whole Chip Zdarsky run.
I honestly haven't read it. I just flipped through it and I saw there's a thing of him like jumping and looking intense. And I was like, hey, that's Tim Drake. Because Tim Drake doesn't strike me as a jokey character. And in that other book, it's kind of goofy and silly. Yeah. But in this, I went, oh, that's Tim Drake, just from the visual.
Yeah. This has been a great Tim Drake the whole time. I don't know, Ryan, what did you think of this issue?
I enjoyed the issue. I was only being quiet because I was trying to remember where I knew Mike Hawthorne from before, or where I was first introduced to him, because I like Mike Hawthorne's art quite a bit. And I guess he did some work on Queen and Country back in the day. And
he did everything. But
yeah, he's been around forever.
Right, but I agree with you. Like, him on a Queen and Country book makes maybe a little more sense than him on a superhero book. But I found myself very compelled by the story. And as Josh pointed out, it's incredibly competently told. You know, I liked the reveal of, like, a venomed out Harvey Dent. I don't know who this character in the Red Hood is. Maybe he's a Red Hood type. But I hope we don't spend too much time in this parallel universe. But, you know, it sounds like we're not going to. If Chip has done a good job of keeping this story moving at a pretty good clip. So I hadn't been reading Batman until Chip came on the book, and I'm happy to now have been picked it up and become a continuing reader again. So.
Yeah, I mean, I like the parallel Earth stuff. I like the multiverse in general, and this is, you know, the same way that Dark Knight of Steel,
Mr. Bones, Jim Gordon.
Yeah, the same way Dark Knight of Steel is fun. You can have fun with those worlds, and a Judge Dredd-esque to venomed out Harvey Dent was a fun foil for Batman here. Even though at this point he's basically just Bruce Wayne because his costume is all tatters and he's wearing a trench coat over it, and it's the pieces are all there. I just didn't think the art fit, especially in contrast to the previous art. But it's still a good book. Honestly, guys, my pick of the week might have been Joe Fixit, number one from Peter David Yildiray Senar, and I wasn't even necessarily going to read it because, as we talked about with this whole resurgence with Peter David lately, that last Hulk, the Fantastic Four book he did, which took place with Joe Fixit in Vegas, that's a hole in my Marvel reading. You know, his whole Hulk run, but in particular his Joe Fixit stuff. I remember at the time, you know, he was the Gray Hulk who could talk and worked in wore a suit and was in Vegas and was a mobster because he would pop up in other things. I was aware of it. I just never read it, so I didn't know anything about it. So when this book came out, I was like, oh. Should I read this? I don't really know. And I figured, what the hell? He hasn't really steered me wrong yet in this return to Marvel. And this ends up being incredibly good, incredibly fun. Peter Parker, Kingpin, and Joe Fixit all collide in Vegas. And I love the classic Kingpin with the ascot.
Yeah.
I thought his Peter Parker Spider-Man was really strong. And there was a couple of really funny visual jokes. And I'm into it.
You talk about drawing Peter like an adult. This guy's a hunk. Look at him.
He really is like looks like an 80s, maybe early 90s sort of Peter Parker, though. Sans mullet. He must have had a mullet at some point.
Yeah, for sure.
What's interesting is that when I first started reading comics, so 88 or so, when I was like 11, that was the Joe Fixit time. Yeah. And I didn't know comics. You know, like I knew the ideas of the characters, but like I was getting into it and learning it at that point. And one of the first books that I was reading was Wolverine. And that, it was like Claremont Buscema Wolverine. And he was on one of the covers. And I just thought, I was like, wow, that looks awesome. Like that's the most I knew. I don't even think I knew what the Mafia was. I didn't know that, what that style was going for. I just thought, that's really interesting. Why is he gray? You know? And I kind of thought it was cool, but I never really knew anything about it because it was too early for me to sort of get into these side version or whatever. But I've always been kind of interested in it, basically. And so when this came and I saw Yildiray Cinar doing like a really competent different style, like a you know, like an early 90s, late 80s kind of style, pre-Image Boom style, basically. Because Yildiray is an incredibly dynamic artist, but he toned it down here in just the right way. For this story, and it was super fun. And I have to say, I sent this to Connor last night, but the last page of the book, there's a 4-page panel that goes down. I'm sorry, a 4-panel sequence where one of the thugs on either side of Kingpin in the back of the limo points out, so you're bleeding a little bit. Third panel cracks him with the elbow, which is wonderful storytelling. And then the last panel, his neck is clearly broken, and they're just sitting next to him quietly with this dead guy. And it's just, it's when we talk about comic book storytelling and we talk about, you know, setting a tone and doing the beats, it's perfect. Like, that's exactly what I mean.
Peter Davis had health issues over lately. He had a stroke and a heart attack and was in the hospital. So I'm glad that he still has books coming out because that's you know, his income for him. But I don't know when he wrote this. I don't know if he's got more coming out, but as we talked about with all of these miniseries that he's been doing for the last couple of years, he's got it. He's still got it. Oh. And his books are incredibly well written.
And there was a nice little one-page explainer of who Joe Fixit is, including a long quote from Peter David about his idea for creating Joe Fixit in the first place. And sometimes I find those a little tough to get through, but I was really interested to learn, you know, Peter David's perspective on creating that character and then a little bit of the history of what's come before. So
I mean, it's silly. They're all none of them recognize the Hulk. Like, yes. At one point, when like the hat comes off, and you're like, okay, well, maybe the hat is throwing them off. But even Kingpin's like, who is this person? I'm like, it's the Hulk.
It's that, right in front of you. The best part is that Peter says that. He goes, why aren't you putting one and one together here? I what I love most about this renaissance, you know, of Peter David is that he's doing comics of an earlier style. But it doesn't feel retro-y. It doesn't feel, it's just good. It's like everything that was good about it then and very little of it that was bad about it then. It's not dumb. It's not insulting my intelligence. It's just saying, let's strip this stuff down to what's fun about it.
And, no, it's a distillation of.
Yeah. It. Yeah. Which we see a lot in art. We see a lot of different styles. We're just talking about Phil Hester, you know, the way that he draws. You can do that in art much easier in comics, but in the writing, it's really hard because people, you know, label you as a throwback writer. But I think he's riding that line just right. This should have been short, but it was great.
We had the wrap up to Gene Luen Yang's Shang-Chi saga with Shang-Chi, Master of the Ten Rings, number 145 or number one or whatever. But this was a one shot
that wrapped up. I thought this was going to be the next volume, and at the end,
so did I.
Oh. That's why I put, or also number one in the script, because I thought it was worth pointing out that they labeled this as a number one.
I thought it was the next volume because they keep renumbering or retitling these volumes every six issues or whatever, because it's probably
maybe now they'll keep reading it.
Clearly not catching on, but then at the end it said the end, and I said okay, well maybe it's the end of that, and then next page, nope, it's the essay from the writer,
the afterword.
So
the essay always tells you when the book's over.
That's how we know now.
Now we know.
It's like that one little drum kick at the end of a song. You're like, oh, there you go.
So I thought this was a good issue. I thought
it was.
I was really into it. I haven't been into the entire 24 issues he's been doing here, but I thought this was a strong classic. And I say that not knowing what a classic Shang-Chi story is like, but it felt very classic, and it was a good one shot you know, one and done story.
It was a good epilogue. It left us in a good place. It did one thing that was really interesting is that it let us know where Shang-Chi came from. In the sense, like, the whole time, like, why is he so good when everyone around him was so evil? His mom was trapped in a bug universe. His dad was, like, the most evil. And he goes back in time. You're like, oh, you see what happened. And what one of the things that was really nice is that there was two brothers. And the dad's, I mean, it was not subtle, but the dad was like, I don't know what I'd do without my brother. You know, and earlier they'd said, oh, he's still around. And so without saying, then he lost his brother and he turned, you know, they let you know, but without spoon feeding you.
All we needed was a moment of Shang-Chi's dad talking to his mom, being like, huh, what a nice boy, Shang. That's a good name. Like, you know.
They didn't do that. Like,
they could have.
Like the Marty thing.
Yeah, it was close.
Yeah, it was close, but he didn't. He held back on all those things.
Shang should have called himself Calvin Klein. I thought, you know, I was thinking while reading this, I actually stopped and thought about it for a minute, because these books haven't been terrific. And the new Superman wasn't terrific. But Gene Luen Yang is a terrific comic creator outside of superheroes. And I thought to myself, maybe he should just not do superheroes because his talent lies elsewhere. But I thought at the end of it, I thought, no, this was a really good issue. He's very good at this too.
I really enjoyed it. And I know what you're saying. It isn't quite what you expect out of most of these, but if you can adjust, and it isn't all the stories he does. It isn't, but you know, there was a certain point where I got in the groove of this and a new issue would come out and I really enjoyed it. But before that, there was a point where I was like, well, should I keep reading this? And I'm glad I did, because I really dug the whole thing. Not like best book of the year, just, you know, oh, this is a fun little story, and it exists sort of outside that bubble, and there were interesting moral things going around the whole time. That is the other thing I think that was good.
Mosley, number one from Boom Studios. It's a new comic from written by Rob Guillory, drawn by Sam Lotfi. And
Lofty.
Colors by Jean-Francois Bellieu. Great team here.
Yes.
That's not a typo in the script, Josh. That's transcribed directly from the book. It's Lotfi.
Lotfi.
Really? Have I been reading it wrong forever?
Yes.
Yeah.
He was part of the iFan base for a while, I think.
I don't blame you for thinking I mistyped, but I double checked.
Sam Lotfi is terrific. A couple years ago when I made that comic book for my job, he was one of the artists on my short list to get on the book. Mm-hmm. Wasn't able to get him, but I ended up getting another great artist anyway. But I always have liked what I've seen from Sam. Yeah. This was interesting. I was super into it, and then I was super kind of not into it. But I'm still going to read it, I think, going forward.
So it starts off almost like an episode of Black Mirror, where you've got this family, you know, a father, a mother, and a young daughter, and the father is doing this some sort of experiment, and they're standing in a hangar, so I thought, like, he's going to space, it's going to be a time dilation, Josh is going to love it. But then it turns out they just drive him to some neighborhood, and it seems like he's supposed to spend a year raising this robot, presumably training an artificial intelligence to be more human. And I thought we were going to sit with that for a while, but very early we jump cut to the future, where he's an old, bitter, jaded man who's a janitor at a school, and the robots are cleaning up piss, and it became this whole other
thing.
Or refusing to.
Which is like the big giveaway.
Yeah.
It's funny, you say Black Mirror. I was saying, oh, it's like the Twilight Zone. Because I'm old. So I loved that part. I thought it was interesting, the idea that there was this whole neighborhood of people who were trying to train AI, basically, to be more empathetic, be more, you know, understand humans. Basically, AI is here. We have to train it. And I thought that was interesting. And then we right away cut to the dystopian superhero sci-fi future. I was like, oh, okay. Well, that's less interesting than the first five pages were. And that was where I had to recalibrate. And I still think it's interesting. I mean, it was some funny bits. The baby mugger was funny.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea that this is the technology is completely out of our hands. And it's not, you know, the idea of this book is we've given over society to technology, and it's gone horribly wrong for humans.
The issue ends with the main character, this Mosley guy, becoming sort of a amalgam of a Black Hammer Thor, Moses, and John Henry, because I think that him being named Mosley is intentional, because at one point the entity that gives him all these powers as he's dying says, free my people, and it was very much a let my people go burning bush moment.
And Rob is not like he's got a Christianity bent through his stuff.
I think there's an interesting thread there of sort of a Moses allegory, but escaping an AI controlled society rather than, you know, enslavement. That to me, there's an interesting hook there.
I find it difficult to separate myself from the creator because I'm so familiar with Rob's work over the years, and I've spoken to him, and I found myself. I've done this before with people who are known primarily for art and for a really specific style of art, a sort of cute, jokey, fun, great storyteller and all that stuff. But it had a tone to it, and he did Farmhand, and this started him towards that. But there was still jokey, fun elements, light elements in the art in the background, even though the story was more serious than say like Chew was. And in this, like, I was really impressed by the sort of next creative leap that he took.
I did think
And so that alone, it's really interesting for me to read. I thought it was pretty good. I thought it was pretty good, especially in a direction that he hadn't done. I was like, oh, this is pretty aspirational. It's a bigger story to try to tackle, and I think he's doing it pretty competently. It'll be interesting to see where it goes for me, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for years and years we had fascist anxiety comics, right? Mm-hmm. And then we've had environmental anxiety comics for a while, and now we have technology anxiety comics coming from, and not that any of those were wrong. It's just funny that those are the trends that happen in comics. And he even says it in the essay in the back, like he's like, I'm not a Luddite, but I understand technology is we're getting completely out of hand with it. And this is, you know, he's working through his anxiety here. And yeah, I mean, I was hoping we'd live with that. Or maybe we'll flash back to it. I thought it was a nice, creepy tone in the beginning.
So that part was interesting, though, because the question you want to answer is, well, how did this go wrong? He's a good guy. You know, like, he was telling them everything about it, but then you throw that into the machine, it gets jumbled around, and what pops out, you know, is what creates this future that they're in. And, like, his daughter is all into it, and he's not. That's the only thing that I was saying, oh, it's a dad who has issues with his family. That's Rob. No, it's just that, you know, that's what Farmhand is largely about. I know that Rob is a father. He has a bunch of kids. I want to say he has 3, maybe 4 kids now. You know, this is the stuff that's on his mind. I did a talk split with him a few years ago when he was starting out Farmhand. And so, you know, he's a little bit of a hard on his sleeve creator, I think. He's a lot of his personality in there and the things that he's thinking about. So, you know, that's his thing. Like Rick Remender's thing is self-loathing.
The opening of this, the book, reminded me of this movie. I know neither of you guys are horror movie guys, but there was a movie that came out a couple of years ago called Vivarium with Jesse Eisenberg and Imogen Poots, who's a very fun name to say and a great actress.
It was fun to listen to you say.
Yeah. So the two of them are a married couple who get like stuck in this neighborhood. They're presumably going to buy this house in this neighborhood. It's very suburban, very samey, you know, pretty ticky-tacky little boxes. And they get trapped in this house and they can't get out. And then the next morning there's this kid there and they have to like raise this kid, even though they don't want to. And it becomes this whole, like, there's a species that parasitizes on humans and it's creepy and it's fucked up and it's good.
Yeah. I thought it was so different than what we've seen from Rob, and especially in the beginning, that I was really impressed. It's like, oh, he's doing a really good, creepy sci-fi thing here. And it wasn't less good. It was just more standard after that. It's like, we've seen the techno dystopian future before. There's even superheroes flying around somehow.
I think those superheroes are flying around in the metaverse of
My point is, like, it felt more what I've read before as opposed to the beginning, where I was like, oh, this is different.
It's Snow Crash, it's Ready Player One,
there's a story in Ted Chiang's compilation Exhalation that is very similar, has some elements of this, of like raising AIs to be functional, so but it's good. I will be sticking with this.
Yeah. You got to ask yourself why it's not an image book.
They paid him. I'm not kidding. Like, I don't know that for sure, but you know, image, you know, you're technically not paid, but a lot of top creators will get advances on those things, and I'm guessing they weren't willing to do that at the level that, you know, that he needs to pay for things, and so he goes to, is it Boom?
Yep.
Yeah. You know, Boom's going to pay for it up front. Not like, you know, not like Vertigo used to pay or anything like that, but you can probably make a living.
Let's move on to Star Wars Corner.
Yes, let us. Charles Soule is still writing this book. Andres Genelet is on Art, I actually was behind on issues on this, and I decided not to catch up. I decided just to jump in and see what was going on, because Star Wars famously has a
How
nice
far
little,
behind were you?
More than 10 issues.
Oh, shit.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm pretty far back there. So, I just...
Like a year.
But I decided just to go for it. And because I was like, well, it's Star Wars. There's always a recap page because it's they got to do the.
I think you should read
the
last issue or two leading into this. There were good issues and good concepts.
I will. I'm going to go back. But the thing I got far enough in the series for them to introduce Holdo. So Laura Dern's character from Last Jedi. And I'm not going to get into a whole Last Jedi thing, but I'll say Knives Out, Glass Onion was great. And this the book, they're in some sort of weird nether space. And I guess the only real comment I had about this book is. You know, I think Charles Soule is still writing these characters well, but I think Andres Genelay's art is the simplest in terms of like cartoony style, quote unquote, that actually really well represents the actors. Does that make sense, Josh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's,
like, he's clearly not tracing Mark Hamill, Laura Dern, any of them, but they're recognizably those characters.
I agree, and that's the way to do it.
Yeah, so I just wanted to give some kudos for that.
Is the time frame of this book still between... Star Wars and Empire?
It's between Empire and Return.
Yeah. Like, Luke is in his, like, I think he's in his Black Jedi.
Well, Han's frozen in carbonite this whole time.
Right, okay, you're right, yeah. So we've been in between Empire and Jedi this whole time.
That's why Lando is with them and not Han.
But you know, Luke has Jedi powers now. He's functional.
They're in some weird nether region where the Force doesn't work very well.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting concept, actually, I think. It's still worth it. I've been reading all these Star Wars books. Just the main title. Every time I try one of the side ones, even if everything about it seems like I'd like it, I don't. So I stick with the main one. I stick with Darth Vader.
Yeah, those are the only two I'm reading at this point, is Darth Vader and Star Wars. Even if I'm a year behind. I will catch up.
If you're a year behind, can it be said you're still reading the book?
Yes. It's a state of mind, Connor. It's a state of being.
So those are the books we wanted to talk about, but at patreon.com/ifanboy, every patron... who supports the show can vote to add a book to the rundown. It's called the Patron Pick. And this week, in our return to the show, we had three or four books garner almost all the votes. And the book that ended up winning won by one vote. And it was Scarlet Witch, number one from Marvel Comics, written by Steve Orlando, drawn by Sarah Pacelli, with colors by Matthew Wilson and letters by Corey Pettit. And I'm assuming this is a miniseries, but they don't tell you until issue two anymore. So we'll find out if you're trying to trick us into buying comics.
And the patrons force your hand.
No, I'm just saying they don't. They assume that no one buys miniseries anymore, so they don't tell you until issue two. So we'll find out if it's an ongoing or not.
Russell Dodderman designs a hell of a costume. I'll say that.
Yeah, I mean, Scarlet Witch doesn't have it anymore. She used to have a costume, but her stuff, as long as it's always in the same vein, it always looked good. So this was the story of Scarlet Witch has basically a little emporium. In, I guess, upstate New York, that she runs with Darcy from the Marvel movies. And anyone who is in trouble who needs her opens the door, and the door opens up into her store, the back door of her store, and then she helps. Sort of like a magical detective. And that's sort of the conceit of the book. And here there's the town that's been taken over by the not purple man, and she has to defeat him. I find with Scarlet Witch that. The more I know about her, the less she makes sense. And it's almost better to not focus on her, because then I start asking questions and it doesn't make any sense anymore. Like, her powers don't make any sense anymore. She can just sort of do anything. It used to be the hex powers, and now it's like she can just recreate anything or do anything with her powers. And like,
I feel like that was always the case with her.
Right, that's what I'm saying. It's always better to not have her be the main character, because then you don't focus on it.
And then in the MCU, they landed on something, and it's kind of made sense, but then they added some to make the stories they wanted to tell work better. But, I don't know.
Well,
I feel like they've been
toying around with, like, there was that whole thing in Avengers Disassembled when Stephen Strange says something about how, like, chaos magic isn't a thing. I've never known what Scarlet Witch's powers actually are. And now they seem fully embrace the idea that, like, Scarlet Witch is way more powerful than Stephen Strange, the sorcerer supreme of the world. And I'm just kind of like, okay, well, I don't
fully
understand.
She should be sorcerer supreme.
Yeah, like, how does that work if the sorcerer supreme can easily be bested by a mutant with magical powers?
Words have meaning. Supreme means something.
It means it comes with guacamole and sour cream.
So this issue was fine. Like, you know, as a one-shot story of her going to rescue this town, it was fine. It introduced the characters. It introduced their dynamics and their abilities. And, it did all the things you need to do with the first issue. Sarah Pacelli is very good. Matthew Wilson's very good. It did all the things that this kind of first issue should do.
Steve Orlando makes comics.
So, you know, there's some writers I just don't respond to that are very popular, you know, Al Ewing, those, you know, Gail Simone, those kind of. But Steve Orlando's another one of those who just, I see his name, I don't get excited. His work, and I've given him a pick of the week before. It's not impossible. I tried to take everybody, you know, at face value for when I read the book. But it just, you know, overall doesn't really do anything for me. And this felt kind of like, okay, this was fine. It was a good comic. It just didn't do anything really to interest me other than to make me ask a lot of questions about Scarlet Witch. But I don't know.
I think it was fine.
Yeah.
I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. It was fine. I wasn't terribly... starting a little shop seems weird for her, to me. Like, I don't know. I just, like, I don't know that I buy this basic premise. Like, it was like, I'm going to start an Etsy page. Okay. You know, like, it's weird. Like, she's bigger than that. She's great. But I guess she's moving down. I don't know. I just...
What'd you guys think of the last page reveal?
I don't remember it. I'm going to go look at it now.
It's Viv, Vision's daughter.
Oh, right. I mean, that's probably where you should go. You know, like there's a connection there. It wasn't obvious to me right at first. And I was like, oh, right, Vision. And I don't even know where Vision is. Where is Vision? Does he exist? Is he dead?
It's a good question. Marvel? I do not have an answer for you.
I don't know that we've seen him since Tom King's Vision story.
I think we have. I just don't know where.
I haven't. Like she's been, like, Viv has been around a lot, but I also don't know what happened to her.
Yeah, she was in that book that, well, the annoying teen superhero book.
You I feel like you need to know that. I think you need to know more than I know to appreciate that. Like, I had to think about it and I was like, all right, there's a connection there and it makes sense, but they're gonna have to do some explaining in the next issue, which is really the big question we have here today, by the way.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the other thing is, like, I don't know who. I clearly don't know Scarlet Witches anymore, because the cover of the issue is the traditional Scarlet Witch, and then they turn the page and she's very dark skinned, and I was very
as
confused.
Is Pietro. Yeah, they make them noticeably more ethnic in this book, which I don't have a problem with on its surface. It does, like you said, Connor, it confuses the issue of, like, okay, well, how is this the same character we've been reading this whole time?
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, I know it's not true anymore. In my mind, she's Magneto's daughter. And she's Eastern European Jewish, but now she's, I guess, not anymore. But it just confused me, that's all. I don't have a problem either way. I was just like, wait, who is this? Because I didn't know who the person was on the first page. Because if you go from cover to first page, they're totally different looking people. So I was like, so who's this? And then, like, it's Scarlet Witch. I was like, wait, what? And then Pietro shows up, and his skin tone is super contrasted to his costume. And I was like, what is happening? Because I just don't, I guess they're different now. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I thought they were still Magneto's kids.
I think that at some point they said, that doesn't make sense. So they changed it. And now what is doesn't make sense either.
Yeah, but eventually they're going to go back and say, oh, they really were Magneto's kids.
Sure they are.
Once they're mutants in the MCU, I guarantee we're going to find out that they were Magneto's kids all along.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is interesting because they usually try to match the MCU. And so I was like, what? But whatever. It just kept threw me off. I was like, I don't understand what's happening. I clearly don't know Scarlet Witch anymore. And this is not how she's portrayed in the other book, so that was also confusing.
Yeah.
It's not the book's fault. That's not the book's fault necessarily. Well, kind of is. But not, you know. This was fine.
Yeah.
This was fine.
Agree.
Are you gonna read anymore?
The new costume.
Yeah, the costume's cool.
Maybe. Maybe. Like, I think there's a chance here that this could be a better book.
Are you more interested to read it if it has a miniseries versus an ongoing? Or does it matter?
It doesn't really matter.
Either way,
it doesn't matter to me either.
I'd read it as long as I was interested in it.
I think this is a next issue make or break for me. If the Vision connection becomes interesting, I will keep going with it. Otherwise, it'll probably drop off.
I mean, you know, her history with kids is not, you know, it's a problem. So it's that could be an interesting story.
Of madness.
Yeah.
That's what I hear.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a game time decision whether or not I read issue 2. Let's rate the book. So that's our sticking with it part, which we've been falling off of lately, but we're not sure. Let's rate the book. Ratings. Scarlet Witch number 1 out of 5. I'm giving it a 3.
3.
I'm giving it a 3.25 for Sarah Pacelli's art and the Russell Dodderman redesign.
Fair.
All right. So there you go. There's your patron pick. Scarlet Witch number 1. Patreon.com/iFanboy. All patrons will try to go to the rundown. And the patrons are the ones who support the show directly. There's lots of people who support the show, but they are the ones who say, you know what? I like this show. I'm gonna kick in and help it keep going. We thank you for that. They get to be part of a great community, we hope. There's a Discord server that we spend time on that's fun. I think there's still a Facebook group. And we hope to make it fun for everyone. And to that end, we spent some time over the break, as we've been talking about for a while, to revamp the patron goals, the stretch goals, you know, the things that the patrons get, but also you, the listener, who's not a patron, get for, you know, when we hit certain numbers. We spent a lot of time revamping them and going through what was feasible and possible and fun, and we announced it, and then we found out that Patreon is getting rid of stretch goals. So what that means, we will figure it out. Maybe we'll keep them as an unofficial stretch goals that aren't on the Patreon page. We don't know. We're gonna now figure that out, take a step back and see what they're going to replace stretch goals with, because that seems dumb, but I'm not in charge. And that was part one of the Patreon revamp. Part two is actually more in depth and will be coming soon. It just requires some more work on our part to get it ready. But that part one of the Patreon revamp was revealed to the patrons this past week. Part two is coming hopefully the next week or two, hopefully no more than 2 weeks. Just you'll see when we reveal it why it was work involved. But hopefully it makes the patrons excited. Hopefully it entices you to perhaps consider being a patron. But, you know, we appreciate anyone who supports the show in any way they can, including buying t-shirts at fmo.threadless.com. We have our 12 shirts there. fmo.com/support is our digital tip jar. fmo.com/Amazon is our link to find the Booksblood books, and booksblood.org is our partner for, you'll see sometimes links on the website for those books that help support local bookstores. And we thank everyone who supports the show in any way that they can. So, speaking of patrons, if you give the $5 higher level, you're a patron who gives at that level. We give you, as a reward, a dumb superpower live on the show. And I need to mention that while I was doing the ad read previous to that, Josh had an emergency and had to leave. So it's just Ryan and I now for the rest of the show.
Josh is wearing a gag over in the corner. Josh.
2023 is throwing curveballs left and right. So let's keep going. Ryan, why don't you tell this patron what their power is?
The patron Moni Singh, hopefully I'm pronouncing that name right. My phone autocorrected to a Patron power, Connor. So this is a
sweet tequila based.
Tequila based power. Moni can know or predict the future of any animal she encounters, but she obviously can't communicate it to that animal because animals can't communicate. Like, unless it's like one of those gorillas who knows sign language, there's no way for them to tell the animal what's coming. So it's sort of a Cassandra. A tragedy power of just like they always know what's going to happen to any animal they encounter. They just can't tell them. They can tell them, but
they don't understand.
Yeah. Like driving past a deer on the side of the road, they're going to say, hey, 10 minutes from now, don't try to run across the road.
Oh, wow. That is sad for Moni. It's a lot of emotional
anxiety. But she goes to the shelter and she gets to see the future of all these animals adopted by wonderful people who go to adopt animals from shelters.
Unless they don't get adopted.
Well, that's the risk of.
Right, that's what I'm saying. So it could be a sad power for her or him. Yeah.
But I thought it was an important power to have in our arsenal of many powers.
So animal futures.
Predicting the future of any animal encountered.
Or it's not predicting, it's knowing the future.
It's knowing the future, but yeah. Right. They're always correct.
Right.
It's, you know.
Patreon.com/iFanboy. Thanks for being a patron, Moni. Let's wrap the show.
You don't want to do the second question? I have thoughts. We got time now.
Yeah, I guess we can. All right, so we'll do one email. Aaron T. from England at the moment.
Excellent.
Aaron says, my fiance often has me talk about the origin story of superheroes to help her fall asleep at night. That's amazing. The other night, I was talking about the X-Men Cyclops and describing his power. I'm sorry. The other night I was talking about the X-Man Cyclops. That's a weird...
X-Man's a different character.
Right.
He is the leader of the X-Men, Cyclops. I think that fits.
He's talking about Cyclops and describing his powers. She wondered if he has trouble in everyday life. How does he shower? Does he have to wear the shades in there? What happens if he has an eye appointment? Does he sleep with the shades on? What do you think Scott Summers' everyday life is like? I mean, yeah, it's tough. It's tough. His life is tough. I think the shower thing is not that difficult, though.
Just keeps his eyes closed.
Well, he's like anyone with contact lenses has to do that anyway. It's not weird or unusual to have to shower with your eyes closed.
Or he's got, you know, or he's got ruby quartz like swimming goggles that he can put on.
Right. That was exactly what I thought. I thought it's not so hard for Forge to, you know, get some ruby quartz goggles. I actually had the exact same thought.
Or he's got a ruby quartz sleep mask.
He has, you know, sunglasses. He has his visor. He has those things for all kinds of occasions. So it wouldn't be out of the realm to have a swimming goggles. But also, you know, if you wear contacts and go to the gym and shower afterwards, you are doing so with your eyes shut.
A question I've always had about Scott Summers, and if I know I'm in Ron Richards' memorial chair, but I'm not the X-Men expert that he is the power, like, is the pulsing power of the concussive blast, is it, like, constantly trying to force his eyes open? Or when he has his eyes closed, is it easy to keep them closed that it is for you and I?
Yeah, no, I think it's just, it's not like he's fighting it all the time. That'd be a totally different scenario.
I think that makes his life livable because, like, you know, there are plenty of people who have low vision or blind who get around just fine. Yeah. If anything, you read stories about blind people interacting in everyday life, and, like, a thing that's a problem for them is because blind people tend to be, like, very functional in the world because you have to be to function. That's kind of, it's a tautology, but a true one. People often suspect that they're not really blind and try to trick them.
Right.
And so, like, that's a huge issue for actual blind people. And, like, he basically has, like, sort of facultative blindness where he has to be blind sometimes to function, but I'm sure he's figured out all his tricks and tips for how to make that work for him.
I think that I would say, it's dangerous to sleep, you know, without the visor and you risk opening your eyes in the middle of the night, which we've seen in stories where he's been like shaken awake or something, and he starts blasting the X-Mansion. That's definitely something we've seen. But I would think a guy like Scott would be so disciplined that he would not involuntarily open his eyes. You know, it's just something he's been doing his whole life almost, and so he would be so mentally strong about opening his eyes when he shouldn't. And so I think he's very disciplined. He either has the Forge goggles or he just keeps his eyes shut in the shower. In other situations, he's always got his glasses in some situation. Yeah.
And I think another thing is, my interpretation of the comics is the visor that he wears in combat is the best in terms of protecting his face. Like, if he gets punched, the visor's not going to fall off, but it's also the least comfortable for him to wear.
Sure. Like,
it's the best for fighting, but it's not the thing he wants to wear all the time. Whereas the glasses offer a lower level of protection, but they're more comfortable for him so he can get around in daily life better.
Right.
That's always been my read of it.
Those who get knocked off easily, but he can walk around. How often are you getting punched in the face when you're just walking around? It's not...
Depends if you're Johnny Storm, I guess
so.
and the other question, the reason I actually have been thinking about Cyclops' powers is, you know, with Josh's descent into Marvel Snap, I've been playing this older little match 3 game called Marvel Puzzle Quest, and I unlocked the...
Isn't that just Candy Crush?
Yeah, but it's Marvel, so I get to do it with Spider-Man.
Right.
So I unlocked the Age of Apocalypse costume for my Cyclops character, and in that he only has one eye because his eye was the other eye was slashed out by Wolverine, and so my question there is, does that mean he's half as powerful?
Good question. That is a very good question. I don't know the answer to that. You would assume so, but maybe not. I don't know.
But he's actually a Cyclops now.
Right. I don't know. That's
I don't know great. Either. Like, how powerful are the concussive blasts? If he only opens one eye, is it half as powerful as if he opens both eyes?
Good point. Good question. We'll never
know. Now, the other question is, what do we think about Aaron and his relationship here? If telling his fiance about, like...
Sounds like a good one.
You think?
Yeah. I mean, she's interested enough in his interests, but also...
No, she's not. She wants to fall asleep, but she tells him, like, tell me that boring comic shit, and I'll fall asleep to it.
But recognizes that you know, perhaps the intricate discussion of an origin story maybe put her to sleep. You know, maybe any story will put her to sleep, but she chooses to have him talk about what he's into.
Okay. Well, I hope it's, yeah. I hope
sounds good to me. Cool sounds place. Like a strong one.
All right, good. I'm glad you have an optimistic reaction. Yeah. I worry if she's that bored by by Scott Summers and all the trials and tribulations he's gone through in his life.
Listen, I like this stuff, but I think maybe that would put me to sleep too.
Okay.
You know?
Well, Aaron, I hope it keeps working out, buddy.
Any story told well in a certain tone will make people sleepy.
There's a lot going on in this email. The England at the moment suggests something exciting is about to happen.
Well, I think Aaron's written us for many, many years. I think before he was in France, if I recall, but I don't remember exactly. But Aaron wrote in at contact@ifanboy.com. Thanks for writing in. We got a bunch of, you know, we talked about last episode. At the end of the year, we put all of our emails into bankruptcy. So all those 2022 emails are now in a folder, except for the ones people wrote us after the show came out over the holiday break. We kept those.
Oh, you big softy.
So we have a couple from the break, and then we've had a bunch this week. So thanks for writing in. We're excited to do the emails as always. So contact@ifanboy.com. So now we're in a new month. This is January. We'll have some new shows for you this month, including the regular show. There will be a Booksplode this month. The Booksplode that we plan to do is probably not going to be happening just because it's too long to get done in time. Because we just didn't read over the break. So we'll have to change up, pick a shorter book to kick off Booksplode with. We'll go back to that one next. So can't announce it yet, only because Josh and I have not come to consensus. I pitched one. He didn't respond. He pitched one back to me. I said, well, I guess he doesn't want to do the other one. So we'll have to figure that out. There will be a Booksplode, though. There will also be a Mediasplode later this month in which we'll talk about the things that we watched over the break, the shows and the movies and that kind of thing. And then, Ryan, is your show still happening? Still going on?
Yeah, there'll be a new episode up by the time this episode comes up. And if people liked the pick of the week that I picked this week, they will want to go listen to that episode because it may feature a certain Ryan of the North, I'll say.
Oh. Well, why don't you just say it? Then people will know and then they'll go.
Ryan North's on the show. He had a book come out last year, and he's a casual acquaintance, and another one of my co-hosts, Ben Tippett, is a friend of his. If you read Squirrel Girl, Squirrel Girl at one point goes to college and has a physics professor, and my buddy Ben Tippett is that physics professor, and so we had Ryan North on the show to talk about his new book.
And there you go. So Science Sort Of at sciencesortof.com.
Sciencesortof.com is where you can find it, and anywhere you find your podcasts, probably.
Just like you can find all of our shows. We've had over 1,200 of them. They're all over at ifanboy.com. You can get them there or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can follow us at ifanboycomics on Instagram. That's where you can find what the pick week is before the show comes out. And sometimes the best week in panels we do on there. And individually, we are J.A. Flanagan for Josh on Instagram. I am C.S. Kilpatrick. Ryan is Ryan Haupt on Instagram. And that's where you can find iFanboy stuff. You can subscribe to youtube.com/iFanboy. You'll find all of our old video shows, and we post this show over there every week. And please consider leaving a review or writing a review or leaving a star rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We appreciate that. And that's it. We're back. This is our 18th year in the books. Show number one. This is it. We've returned to the fold.
Happy to be here.
That was fun. I enjoyed that. I've missed the show. I've missed talking to you guys about comics. Did you read all your comics? Yeah, I mean, I read all my comics over the break. I know for sure Josh didn't. Did you read your comics over?
I did not. No, I had too much travel going on over that, and a lot of those travel preparations were, it was either me behind the wheel or me dealing with the toddler. So there wasn't like I couldn't just sit on the plane and catch up on my stack. So.
Oh, I didn't say it was easy. Like the very first week, I read them all. The first week, like it was also a really light week. It was like I had 10 books. I read them all that week. Like, this is great. I'm on schedule. And after that, I fell off. I don't think I read anything the next 2 weeks. And then I spent the last week feverishly catching up because I didn't want to fall behind and do the show and have to do twice as many books in a week. So I got them all done, but I think I got them all done as of like 3 days ago.
I will tell the publishers that I was very grateful for a light week this week.
This week was a light week. The week we stopped was light week, but then the 2 weeks in the middle were not light week. So there was a lot of books to read, but some good stuff in there. I enjoyed it. Anyway, that's it for this week's show. Thanks for listening. I am Connor.
I'm Ryan.
I'm speaking to you from beyond the podcast. Thank you for listening.
And that was Josh, and we'll see you next week.